Hello and welcome to Football Memories and Moments. Basically, we've interviewed people who all share one thing, a love of football. In this podcast, we find out their favourite memory, something personal to them, and a moment that stands out forever. We hope you enjoy, and if you do, please like, subscribe and rate. This week we were joined by Adam Hurry, and he spoke to us over Skype, so there might be one or two sound quality issues, well, maybe quality issues as well, but I'll leave that for you to decide. If you think it's good quality, don't forget to like and subscribe, obviously. Adam is on Twitter at Football Clichés. He's carved out this niche for himself as raising or finding some fantastic things on the internet about football that you kind of didn't know you want to see, but you couldn't do without. And he spoke to us for a very long time, and it was a good chat. And he spoke to us his memory. We talked at length about Euro 2004, and just about the whole generic feeling of the tournament and his first experiences of following England away. And then we spoke specifically about Tony Yeboah, and it was an absolute wonder to also just catch up and research Tony Yeboah's goal against Wimbledon with some fantastic Barry Davis commentary, and it was lovely to hear Adam talk so warmly about Adam Davis as well. About Barry Davis. And it was just a good catch up, and you can get Adam at Football Clichés, and I hope you enjoy.
So, well, Euro 2004 was the first time I'd gone to see England at a major tournament, and indeed the only time I'd ever gone to see England away. Now, before that, I'd never even conceived of the idea of being able to go and watch England at a major tournament. I wasn't ever planning to be part of the supporters club. I was about 21 at the time, and I'd just finished university. It was an amazing time to consider going to do it, and so there I was. So me, my brother, and a few of our friends went through this kind of labyrinthine process of booking the tickets via official sources, and it's very much a lottery at that stage. You just get what you're given, and I believe one of the tickets we got was for one of the other group games, Switzerland versus Croatia, and we thought, oh, that's not great. And then a couple of days later, we got an email from UEFA saying, terribly sorry, really huge apologies for this, but we've had to switch the game, switch the venues, and you will be watching England versus Croatia instead. And so that was great news. That was so we booked a couple of weeks to go and stay in Estoril, which is just down the coast from Lisbon. And so the stage was set to go and watch England at a major tournament for the first time. And bearing in mind, under my belt, I'd had the experience of watching Euro 96 on TV, and the same as everyone else, I'd kind of soaked up what it's like to be behind England all the way, and then have your hopes dashed at the last. So, but with Euro 2004, it had this kind of added bonus of that squad that we had, which was, you know, it remains to this day probably the greatest squad of players England have ever had at a major tournament. So tremendous amount of excitement. But I'd like to kind of place in context Euro 2004 as an England fan. Euro 2004 perhaps marks just right at the end of this kind of era where it was kind of acceptable to pronounce your loyalty and hopes and dreams for England, both as a football team and a country. And, well, I've never really considered myself particularly patriotic in a football sense at that time. I thought I very much was. I thought it was acceptable to pin your hopes on a set of England players, no matter who they played for at club level. We didn't actually fly out to the tournament until after the first game, which we lost. I think we lost 3-2 to France, which was one of the games of the tournament, really, in hindsight, because we had Wayne Rooney, who was at his kind of marauding bull-like best at the age of 18. But England, being England, kind of threw it away, and Zidane, I think, scored a free kick in the last minute
to win the game
for France.
Yeah, I think
that was the kind of that match was perhaps a kind of microcosm of English football at the time. There was Gerrard being Steven Gerrard, David James being David James and Wayne Rooney being Wayne Rooney, with sort of Beckham perhaps sort of flitting around, you know, blood, sweat and tears in the middle somewhere. So it was a cracking opening to the tournament. I don't think anyone came out of that game with their hopes dampened. It was more we were unlucky to lose. Bring on Croatia and Switzerland.
And yeah, going back to the France game, I think it was 2-1 if I remember rightly, but I do very much remember. I do very much remember Zidane free kick and David James.
Yeah, you're right.
And David James.
Yeah, Zidane scored twice in the last 2 minutes. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think didn't Lampard go off with an injury or something like that?
I'm not sure. No, my memories of the game itself are very vague. I remember watching in someone's back garden or something, and just thinking, you know, in a couple of days we're off to go and watch England at a tournament. I hope they don't completely flop in this first game, and I don't think they did. I don't think the prevailing mood afterwards was a negative one. I don't think we thought our hopes had been and gone. We knew France were a good team. Obviously, they'd had a terrible World Cup in 2002. If they didn't qualify. Yeah, they did qualify. They lost to Senegal, of course. So France were kind of on the downturn, but still had an amazing set of players. And Rooney kind of just tore through them in that first game. So we flew out, yes, shortly afterwards. England then beat Switzerland 3-0. We weren't out of that game. That was in Coimbra, I believe. But that was when Rooney really launched his England career, a couple of goals and... the second one, I think, was actually quite fortunate. I don't think he should actually be credited on it. Hit the post and then the keeper. From memory, I don't remember that win really getting the nation going either. It was really the third group game against Croatia in Lisbon, which was obviously it was a bigger stadium. It was the centre of the tournament. And that was the first game we went to. And maybe a lot of football fans kind of can sympathise with this feeling, but especially at such a big tournament and in such a big stadium, that moment when you walk up those steps and you get to the top of those steps and you finally see the expanse of green in front of you and you realise what it is, where it is you're at, and you get a grasp of the size of the stadium. And at that stage of my life, you know, I was 21. I hadn't been to that many football games really. I hadn't been to a lot of games in the Premier League. And I wasn't really prepared for just how monumental a kind of game at that level could be. I don't know. And there were some strange things that happened. We sat in our seats, and within a couple of minutes in the build-up to the game, we saw an England flag on which was written the name of our local pub back home. Completely unconnected. And we thought, what on earth is happening here? And that game stands out. That game for me is easily in England's top five performances over the last kind of 20 years or so. It was wonderful. Croatia, we shouldn't overstate things. Croatia weren't a top level team. They had some handy players, but they were living perhaps on sort of past reputations a little bit. But England in group stages can never kind of turn their nose up at any sort of win, let alone a 4-2 win. On primetime TV at the kind of showpiece stadium of a major tournament. And Pierluigi Collina was the referee. It felt like a big game. Rooney's two goals were just kind of a blend of explosive power and then just some, you know, composure beyond his years when he sort of gave the goalie the eyes and put it the other side of him. And Scholes and Lampard scored either side of that. And you got Scholes, Rooney and Lampard scoring in the same game, you just think, well, this is England coming together. This is exactly what we're looking for. So obviously that took England through to the next stage. And I remember then, again, you know, placing it into the context of this being sort of right at the end of the era where it was okay for everyone to pull behind England and really push them onto the knockout stages. I thought this was going to be England's moment. This was Euro 96 all over again.
Do you think that 90 minutes against Croatia were, or that performance is probably his single greatest moment in an England shirt?
It seems quite strange to say, because he did have a long career with England, and he obviously went on to break the goal scoring record. But I think, and we know that his record at major tournaments after Euro 2004 was incredibly unremarkable. So despite the fact that he scored goals at a very steady pace for, you know, a good 12 years after that, it's very hard to argue that he excited anyone any more than he did at Euro 2004. So from that moment against Croatia, where he kind of, it was a sort of Rooney goal that everyone could identify with. You knew that he was going to get the ball out of his feet, fire it across the goal on the left-hand side, flawless trajectory, keeper may have got fingertips to it at best. So from that moment on, all the way through to the moment that metatarsal kind of snapped against very, very early on against Portugal in the quarterfinals, that's pure Rooney. That was the window of pure Rooney that we never ever saw again, unfortunately. He may have developed as a player. He might have developed a few more subtleties to his game over the years and become a more well-rounded player for United and England. But just as a sheer instinctive footballing animal, that kind of summed up England's tournament then, because we didn't really need Rooney. We had a wonderful squad of players. We had Michael Owen just after his prime. We had Beckham and Gerrard and Lampard. And so Rooney was just kind of the icing on the cake. He was kind of the garnish, really. But he was a good garnish to have, because if defences didn't know anything about him, they should have done their homework. And if they did know about him, then they were still getting shocked for his sheer aggression. And he respected no reputations. And so Croatia 2, England 4 was the real pinnacle of that tournament. It could only get worse from there. Unfortunately, it did.
Just to come, we'll come on to the semi-final, to the quarter-final, sorry, and we'll deal with how that went in the end. But do you think that even a gutsy or a old-fashioned England, a glorious failure would have been acceptable because of just how bad Euro 2000 was?
I think, as a footballing nation, we're kind of hooked on heroic failures. We always have been. I think we're as much in love with heroic failures like Euro 96 and World Cup 86 as we are with 1966, as when we actually did win something. I think it's quite a seductive narrative to get sucked into. But it was an immeasurably better squad 4 years after Euro 2000, with a better manager. Sven-Göran Eriksson doesn't get enough credit for what he did with a stellar group of players. So it was only going to go one way from Euro 2000. Shearer kind of bowed out at the right time, and we had a decent strike force, and with players like Darius Vassell, who really had no business being around an England squad, but Sven-Göran Eriksson, to his credit, kind of wrung some use out of him, and he had great pace. He was a bit of a pain in the arse for a certain opposing defence, and up until that moment, he missed his penalty against Portugal. He was one of kind of the undersung heroes of England's squad, which, as I said, was quite strong, but still had room for the likes of Vassell.
Is Euro 2004 the tournament that, if you wanted to introduce someone with no footballing knowledge whatsoever to the pains of supporting England, would you just pull a Larry David type face and say, just look at Euro 2004? Is that heroic failure in a nutshell?
Yeah, I would do, and not only as just a England's trajectory through a major tournament, but again, from my limited experience, I've only been to it. I went to a couple of tournaments after that, both as a fan and professionally. But as a fan experience, being at the tournament, I'm sure a lot of people who were there would agree that Lisbon was a wonderful city to go and watch a tournament. And I know England fans have had a disgraceful reputation for taking their various qualities abroad, but in the 2 weeks that I was in and near to Lisbon, I didn't see a hint of unpleasantness. It was really, really wonderful atmosphere. So on top of what England were doing as a football team, just as the atmosphere among the fans, as rather basic as the culture may have been among the England fans in bars, it was a wonderful city to be in. And for a kind of fresh-faced youngster like me, who'd never been to a tournament and never seen England away as a spectacle before, I was really encouraged. I thought, no, this is all right. This is, unfortunately, it's not like that anymore.
Yeah, and that's a sad thing, isn't it? Is that, well, obviously, I mean, having said that, Ian McIntosh, when I spoke to Ian, we were talking about the beauty of Euro 96, but, yeah, there were still riots in Trafalgar Square after
Yeah, they get glossed over a bit. It does get glossed over, the sort of things that went on during Euro 96. But, yeah, you're right. It was just a different footballing universe back then.
And ultimately, were you at the Portugal game?
Yes, I was. That was back at the Estádio da Luz in Lisbon again. And I just remember that it was just, you know, it's very so easy to call a game pulsating. But that game was something else. It's the sort of game you only really ever see in sort of second legs of the latter stages of the Champions League. That sort of high stakes drama. And England was so close to at various stages of that match to putting it to bed. I mean, Owen scored a brilliant goal, an instinctive kind of striker's finish after 3 minutes, and we were sat right behind that. And I just remember thinking, this is it. We've got them. Just like Croatia, we're going to tear through this lot again. They just don't know what they're in for. And then obviously Rooney went off shortly afterwards, and I think that deflated England fans a bit as well, because we thought, you know, that might be the turning point. But then that game kind of it was a complete roller coaster, because obviously it ended up Portugal taking control a little bit. Rui Costa scored a belting shot in off the bar halfway through extra time, and then of course, despite the fact that Portugal were the home team, it was pretty much 50-50 support in the stadium as well, so it didn't really feel like a home game. So it felt like a Wembley Cup final in the sense that both teams had a really, really good crack at it, well supported by both sides. And then, of course, Lampard popped up with the most Frank Lampardy goal possible with 5 minutes of extra time left to go. I think he swiveled in the penalty area, knocking home a loose ball. And that was right at the other end from where we could see. Again, it's one of those sensations that a football fan live in a stadium only ever gets to appreciate, which is a goal happening at the other end, and that kind of half second delay of the sound coming from the other end. So that half second when you see a goal go in, but you can't hear the stadium roaring, is an utterly surreal moment. That might as well be your life flashing before your eyes, because it's the weirdest sensation, because it's utterly silent. And then half a second later, like a rush of a nuclear bomb coming towards you, you've got this roar of the fans simply through sheer speed of sound.
What was your memory? What is your memory? Because you haven't mentioned it as yet, and I'm just wondering if it's something that one of these things that skips out. But the most controversial moment of the game. Now, I'm trying to remember my own memory. I, as far as I'm concerned, just like '98, the Sol Campbell-Dislau goals should have stood.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. That was the one where Shearer elbowed the Argentine goal, Carlos Roa, wasn't it?
Say elbow.
Well, I think he led with an arm. Let's put it that way. So, you know, I can kind of understand why that was disallowed. I mean, goalkeepers being overprotected and all that nonsense. I think within those realms, you could kind of understand why it was disallowed. In 2004, it was probably a little bit less clear cut. I'm trying to remember what the scenario was. It was Terry who scored. Is that right?
Think so, yeah. Well, no, I think it was Sol Campbell.
Campbell scored again, and Terry fouled the keeper, didn't he?
I think so, yeah. I'm just trying to rack my brain as well. I mean, you know, we don't do research on this, Adam. It's just how we talk about it. No,
it's pure emotion. It's emotion, not facts.
Exactly.
But the upshot of it was that Urs Meyer, the referee, became the latest. This doesn't really seem to happen anymore. I feel like this is one of the kind of more one of those unpleasant things from English football history that I actually quite fondly recall, which is referees being hounded to the ends of the earth, having their addresses published in the tabloid newspapers and things like that, and their poor wives having to issue statements having to shut their blinds just because this poor guy happened to give a decision against England. So that's betraying my lack of research. I don't actually know when in the game that was, but.
Right at the end of 90 minutes.
Right, okay. I was there, promise.
it leads me to ask, Adam, how much drink did you have during this game?
I wasn't a seasoned drinker at the age of 21. Portugal taught me a lot about how much I could handle, especially in the heat of Lisbon in midsummer. So I was pleasantly surprised by how I managed to stay the course. But to be honest, the nights out in Lisbon were as good as the 90 minutes spent sweating in stadiums, to be honest. So I thought of it as a holistic footballing experience, and it's a lovely city. I'd never even thought of going there beforehand, but I've been about four or five times since. My favourite place in the world. It's a lovely place.
Bemberton, how typical of Wimbledon to suddenly remind you that they're not out of the game yet, which seemed like it when Yeboah here scored the second. Oh, look at that. Oh, look at that. That is wonderful. Oh, that's twice the goal he scored against Liverpool in my book. He'll have another contender for goal of the season. That is without question. Look at that. Left foot, off the thigh, right foot.
I've spent a lot of time trying to decide which of the two goals is better from all perspectives. But when someone as seasoned and as masterful as Barry Davis says that he thinks the Wimbledon goal was better, then who am I to disagree? He's the granddad I never had, so therefore I'm all over it. I'm all over the Wimbledon goal instead of Liverpool. There's so much more going on. There's so much more going on in that goal, and we can discuss it in greater depth.
It is an interesting one. I mean, I remember it at the time. I'm sort of old enough to do that. But one of the things that strikes me about it is, in something I actually did do a little bit of research in, i.e. I watched it once, is so much happens in that first half that for that to be the standout moment is incredible as well.
Well, yeah, I mean that game was already extraordinary for the fact that Carlton Palmer had already curled in a goal of the month contender of his own. At the same end for Leeds, he'd cut inside with his gangly legs and unleashed this beautiful shot into the far corner, and by the time Yeboah had finally got in on the act, it was in fact he'd actually scored beforehand, but by the time he scored his wonder goal, it was actually Leeds were actually 2-1 up, and Wimbledon had pulled it back to 2-1, and so before Yeboah had even considered what he was about to do, he'd actually tried to score from the kickoff after Wimbledon had pulled it back to 2-1. So he had all this going on in the first half. You have 90 minutes worth of sort of cup semi-final drama crammed into one half of a very mundane-looking league game.
It's that bit that strikes me, isn't it? Not only did he try to score from the halfway line, but Paul Heal that's in the Wimbledon goal?
That's right.
He'd made four or five tremendous saves already, including from the thing. The Wimbledon goal came off two heads in one, which was Robbie Earle and Dean Holdsworth. but if we just focus on the goal itself, I'm gonna let you speak at length, obviously, about this.
But, sure.
The thing that I want to point out again, it's to Grandad Barry, as I think you're now going to know him for the rest of your life, is if Barry Davis repeats something twice in his commentary, you know it's impressive.
Yeah, absolutely, because it's kind of affirmation of what he just said, and he thinks about it for a split second and says, yes, that's definitely the case. And as you say, if he says it twice, then who am I to disagree?
And that's the thing, is that it's look at that. I mean, so do you
look at that. Oh, look at that.
Yes, exactly. It's up there with just look at his face.
Because he kind of just follows the trajectory. His voice essentially follows the trajectory of the ball, as any football fans would, football fans' voice would, as they're watching it, and he's reacting to it as it goes in. So it's just his measured joy at seeing that go in. Very impartial. He doesn't support Leeds. He just supports someone spanking the ball in from 25 yards, in off the bar, past a goalkeeper who's only ever known for being beaten from 25 yards by Tony Yeboah.
So we move on to the goal itself, and I'm going to ask you to, this probably isn't very PC, but you sat next to a blind man who wants the goal describing from start, from kickoff to goal. How would you describe it?
Well, you've chosen an incredible scenario, or rather, we've chosen an incredibly difficult goal to describe to a blind person, because there is just so much going on in it. But what a wonderful case study it would be. So bearing in mind, this is about 2 or 3 weeks, I think, after he scored his very straightforward, in comparison, in relatively speaking, a very straightforward volley against Liverpool. You know, it very uncomplicated. It just plopped out of the sky, and there he was. He just belted it in off the bar. In comparison, this is like a Hollywood trilogy of films in comparison. So let's take it from the start. As many kind of wonder goals start off, it came from a just sort of half-hearted clearance. Kenny Cunningham just sort of headed out a sort of loose ball. And Yeboah, by this point, is about 35 yards out, and he chests it down. And the problem with these sort of goals, in hindsight, it looks like he knew exactly what he wanted to do. So, but at the time, let's give him the benefit of the doubt, he was probably still weighing things up. He controls it with his left knee after that, keeping the ball in the air. And perhaps at that point, we were all thinking, oh, what's he got in mind? Wasn't particularly known for his left foot, although to be honest, it was almost as explosive as his right. But by now he's 30 yards out, and he's weighed up that left foot volley and decided against it. And instead, he brings the ball back inside onto his right foot, which takes Wimbledon's Alan Reeves completely out of the game with a lovely dummy. So now he's 25 yards out, and this is the moment. It's a bit perhaps similar to George Weah's sort of full length of the pitch run and goal against Verona, which I'm not a fan of. But it's that moment of indecision about whether he really meant it. But the ball hits his right knee, and it looks like a bit of a ricochet. And I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt here, because it looks like he moved his right knee to keep that ball on path. So the ball hits him on his right knee and sort of bobbles forward now. And he's just under 25 yards out now. Vinnie Jones is around him. And Vinnie Jones, you can see in the replay from certain angles, looks like he could have just about lunged into one of his kind of late 80s era kind of tackles to absolutely take him out. And even he decides not to, which I think is his greatest contribution to football history in my eyes. And after that, the ball essentially is just sitting there begging to be spanked into the top corner. Every footballer, whether it's Tony Yeboah or Tony Hibbert, dreams of the ball just sitting up just off the turf on the half volley. And so there it was, about sort of 23 yards out. He's running onto it at a nice angle, not too straight, and simply puts his boot straight through it. And as you said, Barry Davis by this point is instructing us to look at that. And then as the ball flies into the top corner, he is very much instructing us to look at that.
Is it made better by the fact that just like his goal against Liverpool, Tony Yeboah seems to have this massive skill of swatting it in off the underside of the bar?
I don't think anyone ever disagrees with this theory that most goals look better when they're in off the bar, because although it implies that it was an imperfect shot, if anything, it suggests that the shot was about as far away from the goalkeeper's reach as it could have been. So these are perfect places to put the ball in off the underside of the bar. The Independent, in their match report, said, and I quote, "Yeboah struck a shot that thundered against the bar and continued into the roof of the net, almost splitting both asunder." As if this had been written in the 1800s or something. And actually quite Barry Davis-y, actually, in its tone. But it was no one's ever seen a goal like that before or since, and it's just wonderful. It's pure instinct, because at no stage of that goal, be it his chest down, the left knee, the right knee that took it forward, and actually the shot itself, at no stage of that do you think that is craft. It's not craftsmanship. It's just instinct. It's just, this is where I want the ball to be, I've suddenly decided, and there it is. And that is the only goal I can dream of scoring. I don't dream of scoring sort of Bergkampy chips, particularly. I don't dream of scoring sort of Zola-like curlers. I just want to hit a ball like Tony Yeboah once in my entire life. That's all I want.
It's David Rashida, the Kenyan middle-distance runner, before he went to win gold in 2011, said he a little, or apparently said to his running partner, his stable mate, said, right, today's the day. Did the fact that the following things went, the following things were there on the day. It was a beautiful sunny day, early, late summer. The fact that Leeds had produced one of their best kits probably ever, and I know you're a massive kit fan.
I'm a very big fan of that Leeds kit, yeah.
So all of these things together, the fact that Paul Heald looked like he was wearing his dad's clothes, all of these things together, do you think that's kind of what adds to the goal?
I think early season Premier League sunshine is a very good atmosphere in which to score beautiful goals. I mean, Shearer, Selhurst Park as well, actually, because Shearer, I think, scored a hat-trick on his Premier League debut at Selhurst Park against Palace. Beckham, of course, scored from the halfway line at Selhurst Park on the opening day. This Yeboah goal came in sort of mid-September. So maybe there is something about sort of South London sunshine that is conducive to wonder goals. I haven't considered that as a theory before, but I am strongly considering it now.
It seems a pertinent one, really. And the fact that, again, just from the little research we did, it's almost like it's... That Leeds. I mean, would you be surprised that Wimbledon Leeds would have been selected as match? Because back then it was match of the day, wasn't it? It was the main match, and then all the highlights.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we take match of the day now for granted because it's much more comprehensive than it used to be. It used to be, as you say, a couple of games that they plucked from the day's programme, and then the rest of it was just Gerald Sinstat sort of, you know, mumbling his way through the rest of them. With perfunctory highlights, but if you go back and look at sort of old Match of the Days on YouTube, in the mid 90s, goals like this were benefited greatly from some lovely slow motions sort of replays. There was a really sort of lovely silky quality to their slow motion cameras, and the goals like Yeboah, which was filmed from sort of various angles. There's one from the left touchline, so watching as it's flying into the opposite top corner, that it ends up on Vine, the much missed looping video facility, and I'm watching it in front of me now, and I'm just watching this sort of 4 seconds of Yeboah kneeing it forward, and then his entire body suggesting exactly what he was about to do, Paul Heald sort of grasping the air, and it's just wonderful. There's not many goals I could watch on a 4 second loop, but this is definitely one of them. Just to complicate matters, later on he was asked to decide which of the two goals, the one against Wimbledon or the one against Liverpool, he preferred. And Yeboah was quite clear about this. He said Liverpool was the best goal because it was live on television, everyone was watching, and it surprised people. And he grew up as a Liverpool fan, and he was playing against the team of Ian Rush and John Barnes. And so technically that was his best goal, but I'm a little bit disappointed by that because I can't think of a more satisfying way to score a goal than the one against Wimbledon. But, you know, each to their own.
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? Is that he's you know, he's saying all those things, but in the words of the day to day, if you asked anyone about whether they've had a near death experience and they see the light there in the tunnel, you know, they're wrong. They're lying. you're obviously on Twitter as football cliches. So what cliche would you use to describe that goal? And bear with me, does the cliche "even two keepers wouldn't save that" stand for this?
The two keepers cliche is a wonderful one because it really does emphasize just how brilliantly placed a shot was. Looking at this goal now, I wouldn't bet on two Paul Heald saving it. Maybe if you had 1.5 Neil Sullivan's, they might have been in with a chance. So it passes that test just about. One of the kind of areas of football language I've always been really interested in is the sheer number of verbs there are to describe a way a shot or a goal is scored. And this is a lovely case study for this because Yeboah's goal against Wimbledon probably qualifies for a good dozen of them. You could describe it as fired, rifled, thundered, hammered, powered, slammed, rammed, belted, blasted, driven, arrowed, thumped, lashed, smashed, crashed, any of them. Delete as applicable, because they all count for that one. In fact, you could use them all, and they would all work. Because you know he wasn't one for kind of subtlety. Watching back through his compilation for Leeds, which and these goals were all kind of clustered in a space of about 18 months ish, about a season and a half, because the Premier League in the mid 90s. It was being introduced to the kind of wonders of foreign players, you know, and the overall quality was increasing kind of very quickly. But compared to today, it really was concentrated among these kind of superstar players, well, maybe one or two per team. So for a player to come in and make an instant impact like that wasn't unheard of. You know, Janino made a kind of similar kind of instant kind of impression at Middlesbrough. I remember Asprilla, right from the very first moments of his debut, kind of wowing Newcastle fans. So it was a period in Premier League history where a player could come in and do some damage straight away. And Yeboah's kind of his Premier League legacy is a strange one, because he wasn't around for very long in the Premier League. And 20 years later, he doesn't really feel like a Leeds hero. He feels like a hero for all of us. I feel like we all get to own a piece of Tony Yeboah's memory in the Premier League. He belongs to all of us, I believe.